Good. So this
sound?
Hello.
So this is the eighth talk, somewhere around that. Or this 8 day, this 9 day retreat, completing tomorrow. Some of you are staying on further. Some have to leave earlier. That is the nature of life. But even though some people think, oh, it's getting to the end of the retreat, I've got to leave today, I've got to carry on tomorrow, retreats never end, because the stuff which you learn still stays in your mind and keeps driving you, keeps influencing you, keeps brainwashing you, usually for the rest of your life. I remember some people once said to me that when you hear these teachings, you can't forget them. You may just disappear for a while, do other things in life, but there's something about these teachings which have the ring of authenticity, and you can see that they do give you some meaning in life, some purpose, some, as they say, light at the end of the tunnel. I don't just mean nimitta, I mean some sort of truth and happiness there. And again, it's all concerned to have the insight, the calm, and also the happiness which comes from life. If there was no happiness in this path of meditation, of course, then many people would just give it up. What's the point of suffering? Thinking that, oh, maybe when you die, then you'll be happy. That was that old story, which I love saying, about the idea that when I was doing my O-levels at school, and you know, I used to spend a lot of time playing soccer, and so that doing O-levels at school, I was asked, please do not go chasing a ball. Spend your time doing your homework. Study. Get your O-levels, because if you study and do well at O-levels, it's worthwhile putting the effort in there, because once you pass your O-levels, then you'll be happy. And I believe that. So I worked really hard, passed my O-levels. Was I happy? No, more exams. Harder ones, A-levels. But A-levels, that's university entrance exams. So if you really work hard and do your study and don't chase, it wasn't actually footballs at that stage, it was girls. But don't chase girls. Just stay home, do your homework, and then you'll be happy. And so that's what I did. I did my homework, studied, and of course got really good results in A-levels. Was I happy? No. University now. Even more exams. It was crazy that I really believed, oh, go to a good university, get a good degree, and then you'll be happy. Now look what happened to me. All that study. What did it actually lead me? Getting a degree from that university? If I'd have known I was going to become a monk, I wouldn't have worked so hard. But at that time, you never knew what you're going to do. But at least I started to get what I call suspicious when I tell this story. Suspicious, all this, you know, trying to strive and then you get happy. Because I saw some people had already passed their university exams. You know what they were doing? They had to go and get a job, go to work. It's not easy going to work. Remember the story which I read about, you know, university graduates, sometimes there's so many these days, they can't get meaningful work. So this one university graduate, the only place he could get a job at was in the supermarket. And so as soon as he went to work in the morning at the supermarket, the manager gave him a broom and said, sweep the aisles. And the new graduate said, look, you know, I've got first class honours. I'm a graduate from university. And the manager said, oh, sorry, I didn't realise that. I'd explain how you sweep. I think you can understand that story. So, they had to work really hard. And then you'd ask those, you know, elderly friends, what are you doing? I'm working hard so I can get, you know, get a car. And, yeah, they got a car then. What are you working hard for? Well, you know, I'm going to find a partner in life. Then when you find a partner in life, then what are you going to do? I work even doubly hard to get a place to stay, because houses are really expensive these days. And then once they've got a house, and then they have kids. And once they have kids, well, that's really, really expensive. But, you know, once the kids are grown up and left home, then we'll be happy. So they work a lot for the kids. And by the time the kids leave home, are they happy yet? No, because they're just saving up for their retirement. And they think, when I retire, when I finish my job, then I'll be happy. And when they finish their job, what do? They volunteer. They do more work. Then also, this is the really interesting one, because I used to go to see churches and mosques and temples. Most people who go to the temples are old people in churches. You know why most old people go to churches and temples? Because they think if they go to church or go to a temple that when they die, then they'll be happy. And there's something, you know, really suspicious about that. Why is it most people in life are always putting off their happiness till another time? So you're not exempt from that. You think, oh, when I get Nimitta, then I'll be happy. When I get Jhana, then I'll be happy. When I get streaming, then I'll be happy. So, or some of you, when the retreat finishes, then I'll be happy. So you can see there's a lot of insight, the way that people live their lives. Yeah, sure, you know, there's times you have to work and do stuff. But why is it we always, when we have the opportunity to sit down and do nothing, why is it we can't take that opportunity? We always say that when I fix this problem up, when I get that thing finished, then I'll be happy. Which means you die before you're happy. So there's something terribly wrong there. That's one of the reasons why we have these retreats. The opportunity to stop trying to be happy. The opportunity to stop searching for something in the future. When my kids finish, when I solve that problem, when I get this difficulty out of the way, then I'll be happy. Have you ever noticed, as soon as one difficulty gets out of the way, another one comes. And then that difficulty comes, and then another. And if you haven't got enough difficulties in your own life, then you go and watch Korean dramas, or The Walking Dead, or whatever else dramas they have in this world, just to make you even more excited. What are you doing that for? I remember there was this one monk, I won't say who it was, he wanted to ordain, but he said, no, I'm not going to ordain yet until I see the last episode of Harry Potter, and then I'll ordain, because once I become a monk, then I can't watch the movies anymore. That's really crazy. You know what happens in the last episode? You know, usually the guy gets the girl, the good guy gets the girl, and the bad guy sort of dies. Oh, and sorry, the good guy saves the world as well. That's just standard. You know what's going to happen before you even know. It's just how it happens. You like the drama and the excitement, that's all. But just like predicting the future, if I could predict the future and say exactly what's going to happen next, would that be it? Would you like to know? Really? It's like getting a novel and actually just looking at the last page and finding out who did it. I know who did it. It was Mara. Mara did it. Mara's fault. But in the end, it's why do people like drama? Why do people just want to cause problems for themselves? This is really interesting. There is something about the wandering mind. I thought there was a time when I was sitting nice and peacefully and just the thoughts came from nowhere. So I thought at first. I assumed that they just came in my mind, not my fault. But later on when I became far more mindful and aware, you know what I found out? I discovered it's the same for each one of you. You're sitting there peaceful and you go looking for a thought to disturb yourself. It doesn't come out from nowhere. You go looking for one. It's like you search your data bank of things to worry about. You fantasize, you dream, you plan, and You go through your data bank of past memories. Oh, this is a really good one to get myself upset. Yeah, yeah, you know, this person did that and they shouldn't have done that. Why did they do that? It's not the first time they did that. And you actually seek that and you promote that and you encourage that. And you think, oh, this thought came from nowhere. Yeah, sure. You brought it in. Or the fears of the future. These fears of the future don't happen. All the things I was afraid of would happen never, ever did. I actually said, somebody once asked, I think was it Kuala Lumpur, in Hong Kong, they asked, what's the time I was most afraid in my life? The greatest fear. And just without any hesitation, I told the anecdote of when I was a student and one of my friends was getting married. So you went to the marriage for one of my friends. And so there you are dressed in your suit with all the young guys. And you know, the stupid conversation came, who's going to be next? And so we all pointed to one of our friends, Jeff. I said, Jeff, he'll probably be the next. And then the guys, you know, guys being guys, no one would marry him. And then they pointed to me, my lay name was Peter. They said, Peter, he'll be next. And then again they said, no one would marry me. But what happened, there was a little girl standing next to me and she whispered into my ear, I would. I've never been so scared in my life. I was terrified. Snakes, tigers, I could take those. Oh, that was traumatic. And I made sure that I kept a long distance from that lady for a while. Nowadays, you look back, why don't you laugh at it, poor girl? But, you know, it was lucky she never married me. I did eventually get married to the Buddha, the love of my life. But anyway, why do people want to sort of make dramas for themselves and go back and think of all those things? You've got a whole filing cabinet, you know, of like a memory stick of all these things you can worry about. You know what happens? Sometimes you get the most important ones first of all, you know, which may be worried about, you know, just your health or your kids or whatever. Okay, but you know, when you know, realize, oh, your health's okay, the kids are okay, then what else is there? It's like sometimes when people get bored, they go to the TV and there's, I don't know, 600 channels, and they look around, there's nothing on, anything on. Or they go and look in the refrigerator, just so full of food, nothing to eat. I can understand that. They just look for something. And if they can't actually find it in the refrigerator or on the movies or somewhere, they just manufacture it. There's something to do. Which actually, why? So why did I, I was sitting quite peacefully, why did I go looking for something to disturb myself? Even though it was none of my business. The reason was, is because I was afraid of silence. Fear. Fear of silence. Fear of peace. Fear of happiness. Weird, isn't it? But first of all, silence. The reason silence can be so fearful is that you're out of control. You know, to control, it's like having having a government, having a committee, having a AGM or SGM, whatever you wish to call it. It's a way of managing. We speak. Some people speak too much, some people speak nonsense, just like my mind. The mind speaks this and speaks that. It's a way of controlling and managing. Your safety for your future especially. And so that when those thoughts actually come up, it's all about controlling things, doing something. But be quiet, be silent, it means you're not controlling, you're not doing anything. You really are letting this world be. And for many people, that's really, really scary. If I don't get involved, if I don't do anything, it's all going to go wrong. You know, a lot of life, when we don't do anything, it doesn't go wrong. Actually, a lot of time, it goes much better without us. That's why all those lovely little stories. You know that every now and again you have a power outage and the traffic lights don't work. And very often the traffic flows more freely when there's no traffic lights. Because I've noticed that the light is red and there's no traffic coming anywhere. If there wasn't any traffic light, trust people, they would look around, make sure it was safe, and then they'd go. When still got this article in Jerusalem, there was a strike. And the doctors went on strike. For about 2 or 3 weeks. They did emergency work. But other than that, they were on strike, and they found during that 2 or 3 weeks, the death rate plummeted. Not as many people died. And the doctors weren't working. Please excuse me, doctor. Any doctors here? It was fascinating. Or they noticed that in the United States, they were noticing there was about 2 or 3 times a year, there was big spikes of no people dying from cardiac problems. And they wondered, why is this like 2 or 3 days a year people weren't dying from cardiac problems? And you know what they found out? That's the days when all the surgeons, the main ones, were on these national conferences. Now, of course, there's many other reasons for that. But there's something which is interesting. Why is it that sometimes, many times, we leave things alone, we don't worry about them, we don't interfere, and they heal themselves? The things settle down. It's a nature's way of just balancing itself. If you leave things alone, you don't interfere, and things get very peaceful and still and very, very comfortable. So sometimes you wonder about what that means in meditation. What it means in meditation, all those thoughts, those plans, sometimes go to a contrary end. They're promising that you'll solve problems and make life easier. But all those thoughts eventually make your mind and your body more complicated. Interesting. You know, people tell me, I don't know this, maybe I'm selective of the research I remember, but people were saying about even cancers. Sometimes they find a person had the cancer in their body for, you know, quite a few years. It was pretty dormant. But as soon as you found out you've got cancer, and it grows pretty quickly once you know about it. Worry, concern. That is one of the biggest killers. Worry. And of course, the quote I give, any health professionals will probably want to kick my bottom after saying this, but this was George Burns, the American comedian. And when I think his 98th birthday, he was still smoking cigars, you know, just one after the other. He was drinking whiskey. He was going out to nightclubs till 2 o'clock in the morning, eating hamburgers and French fries. And he was interviewed. He said, "Aren't you concerned about your health?" No, he wasn't that. He said, "Aren't you worried about your health?" And he said, "I'm not worried about my lifestyle." "I'm not worried about my lifestyle," said George Burns. "My wife was, and she died 20 years ago." And the reason you laugh at that was because, you know, there's something true in that. The worry killing you. So, but why do people worry anyway when they don't need to? One of the reasons is because it gives us something to do. Fills a hole. So we feel that we are participating in the world. And this is one of the reasons why it's great. When you're on retreat, you have nothing to worry about, nothing to do, but do you still worry? Do you still think? Why? We're not used to peace and stillness. I don't know if you've ever been in absolute darkness. It was 19 years until I got absolute darkness out in the moors in Yorkshire. And I couldn't see anything. It was weird. Because all my life, I'd lived in cities. There was always some light somewhere. And now, sort of middle of the night, no electric lights. It was overcast, so no stars or no sun. 100% darkness. That was weird. Number two, have you ever had really deep stillness? Stillness where there's no sound at all. One of many of the occasions, and I loved that stillness. I wasn't afraid of it. But I've seen even in small amounts of stillness here in the bush in Australia. At first, when we moved over to Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, some visitors would come in, and you know, they would raise their voice. They would actually speak louder than necessary. I couldn't understand what the psychology of that was, when you just needed to, you know, just to whisper. But they were speaking really loud in the bush. And I wonder, what are you doing that for? And I realized, because they were afraid of the silence, it was challenging them. Why is it that, you know, in, even in elevators or airports, you always have to have, you know, music, you know, all the time? Why? What's wrong with silence? A lot of times, silence challenges us. I remember one of those great times. That's why I like caves. In caves, in the bottom of the caves, it's absolute silence. It's beautiful. Couldn't hear anything. Or the time when I was visiting UK. It was in the winter time, and that time, really heavy snowfall. And it was minus 26 degrees centigrade outside. You want to know what that feels like? You just go inside the freezer for an hour, and then you know what minus 26 degrees must feel like. That was cold. So, being a rebel, I went out for a walk in the snow. It was wonderful. Walking in the snow at minus 26 degrees. I had scarves and hat on. But there was no aircraft in the sky. Heathrow, Gatwick had been closed down. There was no cars on the road. You know, it was too dangerous to drive. All sensible people, instead of what they call mad monks and Englishmen, and I was both, well, you know, inside their house, keeping warm. I was outside in the forest. No birds were flying around. They were all hibernating. No animals were on the forest floor. They were also hibernating. Even the little river was frozen over. It wasn't flowing. Nothing moved in that forest, minus 26 degrees in midwinter. That was magic. Only me. When I stopped walking, stopped crunching the snow, the whole world stopped. Nothing. And myself in the snow, minus 26 degrees. Total silence. Amazing. I didn't really want to walk, but I had to, you know, keep going. So I just stopped every few seconds and just drank in the silence. Moved a bit more. Just had another gulp of absolute stillness. How wonderful that was. Now, a lot of people would be afraid to do that. They would take their iPad or their iPhone. Isn't it terrible that you can't have silence these days? You know that sometimes people think, oh, you need to talk and get all these lectures and all this information to be wise. But I think I mentioned to you about the building surveyor in Serpentine. I think it was in one of the interviews. The building surveyor over in Serpentine, Jarrowdale Shire. I must have seen him a couple of times, but, you know, I didn't really know him. But then he came to say thank you just before he retired. The day before he retired, he came to see me in the dining room in Bodhinyana Monastery, saying, thank you for your car park. Said, what? No one's ever thanked me for a car park before. What are you talking about? And he said he worked in Mundijong, about 10 kilometers from here. That was the offices, the council offices. And of course, you know, being in the council office, the building surveyor, all these builders, they want their approval yesterday, and he's got to really sort of, you know, work hard and deal with other people. And he said, whenever I got stressed out, I just got in my car, I went to your car park and parked there. Never got out of the car. such a peaceful car park, building up on the energy of just the monastery. And then when I felt relaxed, rested, I went back to work. He didn't need any teachings. He didn't need to say, okay, sit down, this is how you meditate. All you need to do is just be there, be calm, and just soak it all in. And I remember this other occasion over in Thailand. This gentleman, he was visiting Thailand, one of the members of our Buddhist society in Perth, visiting Thailand. He went to one of these temples in Bangkok, and he saw there was a young woman, quite young, maybe about your age, dear Yupa. Very young. No, I'm only just trying to butter you up. Praise gets you everywhere, I always say. So she was crying and weeping on a little bench outside the temple. And he didn't know what to do. He thought, should I go up to her and just find out what was going on? Should I go and ask her if there's anything I can do to help? But he didn't know whether that was culturally appropriate. So he saw her, she was really weeping uncontrollably, so he thought, no, better not. So he went into the temple, did a bit of meditation or whatever, and when he came out about an hour later, she was still sitting there, but she was now calm, relaxed. He couldn't help but just going and asking, anything I can do? I saw you an hour ago, you were really weeping and crying, really in distress. Is there anything I can do for you? He said, no, it's okay now. He said, well, what happened? And she said, I couldn't find the keys to my car. He said, but I found them now. And said, that's what people did, when they were upset. They didn't need counseling. They didn't need to be told what to do. They just needed a peaceful, quiet, still place just to be. And just let the stillness and the peace heal them. Which is one of the amazing things about this place. Just sitting out, having a cup of tea, going for a walk. Just allowing the stillness, the relaxation, the peace of a place like China Grove. Let that teach you, heal you. Not thinking and working it all out. Because you all know that when we work it all out, and when we just have all the different translations of what these words mean, you ever notice we always have arguments then? Why do we have arguments? Because the intellectual understandings, that's where they lead to. Different people seeing it from different angles. But I've said for a long time now, the path of deep meditation is not an intellectual path of ideas and concepts. It's an emotional path. A path of learning how to understand what peace is. And learning how to be with that peace. And not trying to capture it in words. Not trying to sort of make a description of what peace is, but actually feeling it, getting close to it. Compassion and kindness. Maybe we can chant that Metta Sutta, may all beings be happy and well. You can chant that, but does that make you really kind? Sometimes we chant it and we don't get kind. So you're chanting the wrong word. Come on, you don't chant it that way, you chant it this way. You do Metta Sutta. May all beings be happy and well. Mosquito. Whatever living beings they may be. Not you. Omitting none except that person in my heart who keeps making a noise every evening. I used to do that when I did Metta meditation in Thailand. I couldn't help myself, young monk. Whatever living beings they may be. Excepting mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, they didn't deserve loving kindness. Have you ever done that? Okay, I give loving kindness to some people, but not to her. Yeah, no. So you thought you were doing loving kindness, but it really wasn't loving kindness at all. And it was some years ago. They ask, what is letting go? What is it? And for years, you've been trying to explain letting go. writing books about letting go, the art of disappearing. So many books about it. What a waste. It wasn't really a waste of time. It did raise some money for the nuns' monastery. But, you know, it's in feeling it, the emotion of letting go. Feeling the emotion of kindness. What actually is it? You can think about it, you can write a book about it. Actually, really being kind, feeling it. And it's this emotional sensitivity and emotional intelligence to understand what these feelings are of peace, of bliss, of joy, of letting go. Just not thinking about it, just being it. And this is one of the paths of meditation which I really, really encourage. You feel it in your body, first of all, the letting go, the relaxation. Because a lot of times people are far more aware of their bodily feelings than their mental states. The emotional world is, for many people, terra incognita, unknown world. But you feel it in the body, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, that this meditation practice has been hugely successful in understanding your emotions as they are exhibited on your physical body. Every emotion, you know, has a counterpart on your physical body. So if you're angry, you can see it on people's bodies. If you're anxious, that's the interesting one, anxiety has another type of feeling in your body. Bliss is another type of feeling. The bliss is a very beautiful feeling on the body because it just relaxes everything and it just bathes it in healing energy. But the anxiety one was one where I was very, very successful, realizing that when you have an anxiety or panic attack, it does create a tension in your chest usually. And once you get to understand that, anxiety is a physical manifestation of anxiety. And that story of that lady over in Adelaide, really chronic anxiety attacks. And she got to understand them, feel them, so she could describe them to me. And then I told her just to massage them with kindness until the anxiety totally relaxed. And when the anxiety disappeared, the physical manifestation of tension in her chest, then her anxiety went at the same time. And that's how she overcame it, cured her anxiety. And even one of the doctors who, you know, many of the regulars here know, he was, he told me this really nice story. He was working in hospital, and Thursday night, one of the patients had chronic anxiety and had an oxygen mask in hospital because, you know, couldn't breathe because of her panic attacks. And they were trying every type of medication. Nothing worked. She got down to the bottom of the list. Nothing worked. What to do next? And so she broke her rules. That's why I can't say who she is. Because she said, okay, well, let's try Ajahn Brahm method. It hasn't been approved by the Australian Medical Association as proper therapy, but what the heck, it doesn't cost anything and it can't be that dangerous. He told her to feel the anxiety when it manifested in her chest. Get to know it. And then with her hand, just massage it, like, you know, the story which I've told many, many times. And, you know, then following morning, she said she went to work. She told me on a Friday evening at Nolamara. That morning she went to work and this patient had an oxygen mask off. Said, I feel great now, thank you very much, I'm going home. Case solved. It's interesting, you get to know your emotional world, how it affects the body. When you understand that, fear, anger, frustration, all those emotional things, they do have an effect on your body. So you can understand your body, relax the body, have a bit of compassion, letting go. And then you go into your emotional world. It's incredible what you can do then. So, you don't need to get afraid, upset, because you're really in good understanding of the way your emotional world, the mind, actually works. You know what peace is? Peace is there anytime. Just like something which you have as an app in your mind. Press a button, peace. And peace comes. You feel it. You're just not afraid of it. You don't control it. You just let it be and take over. Peace. I will now show you one way this is done. Close your eyes. It's only going to be 2 or 3 minutes. You don't need to adjust the posture. Peace. You can open your eyes. Did you see peace? After I kept on saying it, peace. The mind just kept on going in that direction. Every time you said it, the mind was looking there, looking again, again, until it experienced peace. But it was peace. It's so beautiful, so nice, so easy. You can stay there. It's learning how those emotions of peace, kindness. You know that when people would ask me, said, yeah, we should be kind. How do I be kind to my mind? Weird. Things which we thought, I assumed that everybody knew what kindness was. Important stuff. That we don't really know what kindness is. So you can be kind to your own body, you can feel it, and don't be afraid of it. Just cuddle the teddy bear and you can feel some kindness. When you get to know that, what kindness is, what peace is, that is insight. Understanding. Not by looking at the Abhidhamma, not by looking in the dictionary and getting words to describe it. You know it, you feel it, you're there with peace. And that becomes this wonderful state of meditation, healing, liberating. And the more you become familiar with such things, the more that you can employ them in meditation in your daily life. You can remember kindness when there's a conflict. A kindness there. The human being you're talking with. When I used to go into prisons, I remember going into this one prison. Obviously, they're changing. It was in a prison in Canning Vale. It's called Acacia now. I was going in this one prison, and the guards, when I checked in at the control gate, they gave me a little pen, like a little biro pen. And they said, please put this in your pocket. And I straight away I said, look at me, I don't have any pockets. I'm a monk. Oh, yeah, okay. So they said, well, just, you know, hold it in your hand or just, you know, tuck it in the sort of the top of your robe or something. So what do I need a pen for? Because it's not a pen, it's a security device. On the ceilings of this jail, they put what look like smoke alarms. But they're not smoke alarms, they are security, because many people coming, volunteers coming into this prison, have been raped. Guys as well. And if ever you get attacked, point the pen at the little things. They showed me an example of one. Point it at it, press a button, the alarm will go off, we know where you are, we'll come and save you. That's the security system we've just installed. But, he said, Don't let any of the prisoners know this. This is top secret. So I went into my class. The first thing they said, oh, you've got one of those security pens as well. Of course they know what's going on. And I tell my monks this, and nuns as well. You know, just all the lay people, they know exactly what's going on in the monastery. Sometimes people feel that the monks are really quite surprised. How do they know that? It's amazing the grapevine which goes on in the monastery. Sometimes they know things that go on before I do. And I'm supposed to be the abbot. But anyhow, but the prisoner knew everything which was going on there. And this really big guy, you know, he was a fellow when I first taught in jail, was a fellow who said, you know, asked, is it really true that through meditation you can learn how to fly over walls? Is that guy? He became really quite a good friend afterwards. Really liked him, really honest fellow. Strange, isn't it? Honest in jail. Because in jail they had nothing to hide anymore. So anyway, he said, he looked at me really serious and he said, Ajahn Brahm, do you really think you could even press the end of that button, that pen, even let alone point at the right place, before I jumped and raped you? Serious. I said, no, you know, you're probably much faster than that. He said, yeah, I'm really fast. He said, don't be afraid. He said, because you've all been always kind to us, if any of these guys behind tried that, I would get to them first. He said, you're protected, and you've been kind to us. You know, I felt so protected in that jail. Nothing would ever happen to me. I've been kind to people. The kindness, that was my security alarm. Weird, isn't it? It's so true. But that sort of kindness there, when you actually feel it, and other people feel it, it does change the whole ball game. That's one of the reasons why, that when we understand kindness and peace, we're hugely advanced human beings. Even animals won't harm us. You're very, very kind. You can urinate on a snake, like I do. And the snake doesn't mind. I like good old Ajahn Ganha, patting king cobras on the top of the head. But I don't know if I told you that time that I came face to face with a big tiger. Did I tell you that story? The tiger was, you know, maybe half the distance between Ananda and I. Really huge tiger, very powerful, staring at me. And strange, isn't it, that sometimes you haven't got any fear at all. I wasn't afraid at all. That tiger's so huge. And I wasn't afraid, honestly, that was absolutely true. You know where that actually occurred? Where was it? In a zoo. And there's this big iron bar and that tiger. It wasn't my kindness, it was just the zoo. But anyway, this is where the kindness and the peace, you know, rather than the jokiness, that really sort of helps. So you learn these things in meditation. But when people say, well, what did you learn at a meditation retreat? Did you get nimittas? Did you get jhanas? What's the point of this? And you're going to become a monk. You're not going to become a monk or a nun, but still, it's very, very helpful and useful because you learn really important skills in life, learning about peace and kindness, learning just how these things are developed, not through force. How can you make peace by making war? Making war with your body, making war with your mind. You don't make peace that way. You just get what's called collateral damage to your head. Learning how to leave things alone, let things be kind, be peaceful. Which is one of the reasons why we have on the back of the t-shirts, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Such an important part of our meditation practice. If you can do that when you go home, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Have a place where you can make peace, be kind, be gentle. Because sometimes that having Jhana Grove Retreat Center is really useful. The place, now you've been here, you know it. Many of you come here many times. It's just set up for being peaceful, being kind, being gentle. It's important that we have places like this in our world. Places you can come and sit and be kind, be peaceful, be gentle. Places you can serve and get happiness and the joy which people like Bianca get. You know that if I said, ah, oh, take a rest, next retreat you don't have to come. No. You get joy in service, in letting go and giving. It's one of those wonderful, wonderful ways of creating happiness in our life. And energy as well. Okay. There was the time, one of the times I really started to understand about what meditation is, how it works, not by controlling, learning how to make peace, be kind, be gentle. Because on this occasion, I mentioned that the monks were in Thailand, we had to do everything ourselves. And so even our robes, we had to make ourselves. Starting off with white cloth. That white cloth, you had to mark it up in a pencil and draw the lines and sew it into what they used to call the Magadha paddy field pattern. Straight lines, horizontal lines, and then sew it together. And after sewing it together, just washing the grease out and then making the dye, water from the well, which didn't even have like a pulley, just a piece of bamboo with a little hook on the end and a bucket, and you learn just how to get the water from the well, draw it up, a big bowl, the old kamamang, what do you call those, big basin, and then underneath the basin you put the water and the ashes so that it wouldn't sort of get too black, and then you'd make a fire, you know, from the wood in the forest, and then boil that water. The dye came from jackfruit branches. You chop them up with a machete. Make sure you didn't get too much red dye from cutting your finger off, you know, which you soon learned not to do that. And then then boil it and boil it and boil it. And once it was boiled and you got the orange dye out of the jackfruit, then you'd have to filter it and re-boil it to concentrate it. And then you pour that over your white robe and then just beat it and beat it and beat it to get the dye in, then hang it on the line, make sure it didn't streak, always there, turning it and turning it and turning it, and then put it back in again to get some more. Really time-consuming job. So I did that many times. That's actually, you really realize just, you know, the value of a robe when you had to put so much work into it. But then what happened? It became the rule, Ajahn Chah said, anyone who wanted to become a monk, you had to make your own set of three robes, including washing it and dyeing it before you became a monk. You weren't offered it by lay people, you had to make it yourself. So it's really, you know, just hard work. And there were these three monks who were making their robes. And one of them, you know, some of you may know one of those monks was Ajahn Kawesako. His lay name was Shibahashi, which Ajahn Chah could not pronounce. So he became nicknamed Sibat Hasip, which is, you know, like $4.50. So he always used to call him Sibat Hasip, $4.50. And anyone who goes there to see over in Amrawati, Ajahn Amaro, you know what his name was? It was Jeremy. And Jeremy, no, he couldn't sort of pronounce Jeremy, so Ajahn Chah called him Jeremy, which is axle grease. That became his name. So we had fun over there. Just, you know, no egos and just messing around with names. But anyway, so the three monks were making their robes, and they'd already been up two nights without sleep. And it's a long, a lot of work. So the rule was they were supposed to carry on. But I had compassion on them. After the evening meeting, I went to the dying shed and told them, look, guys, you know, I won't tell anybody if you won't tell anybody. You go take a rest, and I'll look after the dye pot for the night. I was senior to them. So I looked like looking after the dying pot and just dyeing everything. And they just went off straight away. And about 2 or 3 hours later, they came back again when the bell went at 3 a.m. And they said, thank you, thank you, thank you, because just getting a 2 or 3 hours rest when you've been working very hard just takes the edge of your sleepiness. And then I had to go to the morning meeting, so I didn't have any rest. And that morning meeting, my meditation was so sharp, no sleepiness at all, full of energy. And I couldn't understand why it was. I hadn't slept all night, and I was so alert, no sloth and torpor, so energized. So I asked in the morning on Alms Run, well, what's going on? Why is it? I haven't had any sleep, working really hard, and I got all this energy. And they said, because I'd been kind, because I'd served, because I'd been selfless, because I'd thought of somebody else. That was worth much more than even sleeping. It was so true. I discovered from that sometimes selflessness, practicing anatta, not what I'm going to get from my practice today, but just letting go, being kind. It's actually weakening the ego, lessening the sense of self, renouncing, not controlling, giving up. All those things, the four ways of letting go of the third noble truth, you're practicing those. And my goodness, it gives you a huge store of energy and bliss. So sometimes, just thinking of yourself, oh, my meditation, my practice, my room, my time, and all these people ask me to do this, blah, 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 blah. If you understood how it really worked, you'd understand why Bianca is so happy. It's okay, she's cooking for you right now. That wonderful service and giving, not expecting anything back in return, it gives you a huge boost of energy. You're getting the emotion, understanding of renunciation, giving, just not expecting anything back in return. It's this wonderful service part of the path. Once you understand the service, the emotion, the joy, the real joy of just being able just to open the door for somebody, be very quick. When Ajahn Chah was still alive, you know what he used to have? He used to do, coming back from Alms Round. He always never wore shoes on Alms Round. Coming back from Alms Round, that before he came in the dining room, all these monks will jump up to wash his feet. About 20 of them, and just he didn't have that big of feet. 20 people to wash his feet. And that was really ridiculous, I thought. Number one, Ajahn Chah was old enough to wash his own feet. And number two, it was inefficient. 20 people, and I thought, why do we have a roster? So, this monk on this first day and then next one. That was, that's what we do in Western ways, rosters. But they didn't like the idea of rosters. And so I could not understand what people were doing. Totally ridiculous. But at least I had my scientific practice. If you can't understand something, experiment. So the next day, I really rushed back from my Alms Round, got everything ready, and waited. I was poised like a cat waiting to strike. And when you saw Ajahn Chah coming, I jumped up from my seat, ran to where the washing place was, and you know what? I got a toe all to myself. I got one of his toes. And I was washing it. What the heck is going on? I got so much happiness out of that. I got blissed out getting a toe to myself. Logically, for the theoretical physicist, that makes absolutely nonsense. I couldn't understand that. But it was real. I was getting my emotional intelligence coming up. Seeing the wonderful joy of service. For that is why, sometimes I open the door for you. I run at the door and see who gets there first so I can open it for you. Get so much fun out of that. Sometimes. All the other stuff which sometimes you do. Sometimes it's, who's on the roster today to wash up? You get in their face. It's not your turn.
but I'm going to do it anyway, for fun. Whose job is it to make the tea? No, I'm going to go and do it first. You rush to see who gets the tea first. So it's a joy of actually doing. You get incredible emotional happiness that way. No, it's not my turn today. I did it yesterday. It's your turn today. He said, yeah, you did it yesterday, and I'm going to do it yesterday as well. Travel back through time and do it again. Whatever it is, I'm going to do it as many times as I like because the service is a beautiful thing to do. The kindness, it's emotional high. It's wonderful. I don't know why more people don't look after one another. Just because the joy which we get for serving. So this is getting the emotional intelligence going. Emotional intelligence of giving, kindness, looking after one another, sharing. All those little things enhance this practice of selflessness. Letting go of the ego, the me, the mine, the self. The more that ego is, the more you think you own, the more you suffer. The more you share, the more happy you are. So this is an important part of what we learn here. Emotional intelligence, the joy. Not get out of my way, this is my meditation. But the beautiful, yeah, you're very happy that you disturbed me. I learned so much from that. Thank you so much for all your snoring. Thank you so much. This is where we have a different attitude. We change our attitude, the way we look at life. Kindness. We learn our emotional strength. On the path of meditation, we can actually understand peace and let it be. We can understand bliss and let it grow on us. It does become quite scary sometimes as you go into the deep bliss states because you're letting go of your sense of self. You can't control it anymore. You do it. You make it happen. And it's self-made. It doesn't work. You abandon, let go, and let it happen. You're not controlling. You're not doing. You are disappearing. It's so beautiful not to be. To disappear. Vanish. In a halo, an explosion. Just like these meteors which you see in the night sky. Those lumps of ice or rock have been circling around this solar system for just so many billions of years, millions of years maybe. Round and round they go, circuit after circuit, like the human being in the circle of rebirth. Round and round and round these little meteors go. Until they manage to meet a planet, planet Earth. And then they meet the atmosphere and they burn up in this beautiful explosion of light, lighting up the night sky. And then they're finished, ceased on their journey. Just like the Noble One, the Arahant, round and round and round. Samsara, and they meet the Dhamma. As they meet the Dhamma, their defilements, their sense of self just all burns up. They go out with this beautiful light, Arahat, going the way in this world, still gone. Simile of the meeting. Now is the time. Go. Sadhu. Sadhu.